COVID-19 cases in Arizona have exploded, but are recent moves by the state too little too late?
We will have to persevere, and it's going to be for some time into the future.
Also, how the pandemic has led to fewer parents vaccinating their kids for preventable diseases. Then Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico on COVID-19 in Indian country and the intersection for Black Lives Matter and Indigenous liberation.
We absolutely are on the same side and the same struggle. It's a history that belongs to all of us, and I really hope that we can stand together.
And we round out the show with a conversation with comedian Rami Youssef about how his team managed to finish their show under lockdown.
I get so frustrated when people are like, man, TV's changing things. And I'm like, no, TV might set a little bit of an emotional palette to open a few minds, but that's not the work.
We got a lot to get to, everyone, so let's get started.
Remember, you are safer at home. The virus is widespread. So if you don't need to go out, don't go out.
Words of warning there from Arizona Governor Doug Ducey, whose state is now in the middle of a COVID-19 health crisis with hospitals close to reaching capacity. On Sunday, nearly 4,000 people tested positive for the virus in the state, nearly double the number of cases reported the previous week. And since the crisis began, nearly 75,000 people have tested positive for the virus in Arizona, with close to 1,600 people dead. Arizona is just one of the states that began to reopen businesses earlier than the CDC recommended, only to see a surge in coronavirus cases shortly thereafter. Similar spikes are being seen in California, Texas, and Florida. And we've been hearing from you in some of those states.
Hi, I'm Gianna from Dallas, Texas. We didn't have clear instructions on what should close across the state at the beginning. And in the past few weeks, local officials have been pushing for a slower reopening, while state officials have been trying to reopen sooner rather than later. Just recently, I've seen the governor have a change of heart in the midst of all the increased COVID cases, but I can't help but feel that it's too little too late.
Hi, this is Kaylin. I'm calling from Phoenix, Arizona, where I do not feel comfortable with the actions our government is taking. We have a rapidly rising COVID cases and hardly anyone wears masks. It's basically a disaster waiting to happen.
That's a caller from Arizona there, where yesterday Governor Ducey announced a 30-day closure of
bars, gyms, movie theaters, water parks, and tubing.
As of today, more than 126,000 people have died in the United States from the pandemic. Dr. Frank LaVecchio is seeing all of this play out in his state. He's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona in Phoenix. Frank, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
So tell us, what are you hearing and seeing in emergency rooms in Arizona as hospitals begin to get to capacity?
Well, I work in a handful of emergency departments in the Phoenix metropolitan area. And I'm seeing what we've never seen before, which is tons and tons of COVID patients. And what I mean by that is I might be working a shift. We have about 40 beds or so in our emergency department. Over half of them will be confirmed COVID cases. And the last few days, almost every day, they have no place to go. The intensive care units are at capacity. We have to wait for someone to get discharged from an intensive care unit for one of the patients in our emergency department to go up. The other half of the beds in our emergency department are those maybe waiting for a COVID test. And a small percentage, maybe 1 in 10 people, are there for non-COVID complaints. So it's nonstop COVID all the time right now.
Dr. LaVecchio, one of the things that I recall being in New York City during the peak of the pandemic here in March and April were just images of emergency rooms at full capacity, people on gurneys in certain hospitals waiting in hallways, and hospital and healthcare frontline workers not getting the equipment that they needed. It was truly an intense moment. Is that the level of intensity we're seeing on the ground in the ER? And how are healthcare workers being prepared to handle this increasing number of cases?
You know, having trained at the hospital where they showed on TV a lot, Elmhurst Hospital, I trained there about 20 years ago. We're not at the extreme where they have so many people in the hallways. And one of the reasons for that is we're trying to protect, you know, everyone that works there, et cetera. We are on seriously plan B, C, and D, where we're taking almost any room we can. In the beginning, it was only rooms with negative pressure where they would have their own ventilation and air gets sucked out. And that's where we put COVID patients. But now essentially they're going almost anywhere, which really, really changes and slows us down. With regard to PPE, we do have an adequate number of PPE. We have appropriate PPE for us. I think it's a lot better in that respect.
Dr. Lovecchio, who are the cases that are coming in? What is their demographic? We heard often, we know that this is a disease or it's a virus that can affect people with what's known as comorbidities, underlying health conditions. We also know that it can affect the elderly, and it also can affect populations that are of color, black and brown populations. What are you seeing there in terms of who is coming into the ER?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it is true that most of the people that do die from this illness are 65 and over, and most of them have one medical problem or so. But the medical problems that they include are obesity and hypertension. You know, I mean, those are very, very simple medical problems that a lot of us, unfortunately, do have. I think the great majority of people that come in that I see are Hispanic or Latin origin. And I think that has something to do with our population, which is, you know, very Latino, but also, you know, they're very relatively underserved. Many of them are blue collar workers. Many of them have taken public transportation or used other areas where they have to congregate, et cetera. Many of them live in multifamily homes. So disproportionately Latino, and the people who are getting killed are the Native Americans. Up north, the northeast part of Arizona, close to the New Mexico border. I mean, if you look at the fatality rate up there, it's incredible. We have no place to send those patients. They sometimes come down to Flagstaff in northern Arizona, and actually some of them come down to Phoenix. So they're really getting hurt hard. There aren't a lot of ICU beds up there. There's a lot of comorbidities. A lot of them live in close quarters.
We are still learning how the virus is spread, but we do know that wearing face coverings, at least, is one temporary measure that many people are being encouraged to do. Doctor, can you tell us why there is such a surge in confirmed cases in Arizona, and whether the mask wearing or lack thereof has anything to do with that?
The first part is relatively easy, because we don't know why we have such a surge now. I mean, this virus, we're going to probably look back on it a year or two from now and have a better understanding. You know, just the other day, it celebrated 6 months, you know, a 6 month birthday, you know, kind of an ominous birthday, but it celebrated, you know, only being around for 6 months, you know, in the history of the world. And we don't quite understand it. We do spend a lot of time indoors in Arizona now at this time. You know, this is kind of, quote, our winter, because we're spending lots of times indoors. And we know being indoors, being close to people, is more likely to transmit it. Okay, so that part is probably true. The other thing is that there's so many, you know, young kids that have it, the 20 to 30 year olds, the, you know, 15 to 40 year olds, who have minimal to no symptoms, who are out and about. There is this culture in Arizona, unfortunately, of people that don't even believe this thing exists, because there's a little bit of separation of the rich and poor, and, you know, a lot of people of lower socioeconomic status will get the disease, and the rich don't understand it. You know, they have, you know, larger houses, you know, able to spread out, able to social distance. And if you saw what happened as soon as they lifted the orders that, you know, hey, we're going to let you guys go about your business as usual, people went nuts. People went crazy. There was pool parties on top of each other. There was, you know, I'm sure it made it to the New York papers, et cetera, where people were doing shots off each other's body at pool parties. And it was just like, you know, this was supposed to be a gradual opening. We're paying the price because our governor, you know, last night kind of hauled things back and said, look, you know, we're going to have to close bars and gyms, et cetera. And, you know, now we're going to go on a shutdown for at least another month. Kids' schools have been pushed out another week. Our hospitals are at capacity. Week over week, I've had the most people in an intensive care unit. And when it could get no worse, you know, the next day is a little bit worse. So we haven't hit our peak yet. Our hospitalizations in general keep going up and up and up. Our percent intubated or on respirators keep going up and up and up. And the lessons we learned from New York is that's the last thing you want to do. Last resort, put somebody on a respirator. And unfortunately, even though we know that and we're intubating much less people percent-wise than places like New York did, or even Detroit or Louisiana, we still have the record numbers. You know, we are bulging. You know, the data will suggest that we are 86%, 88% capacity in our intensive care unit. And I have to say, you know, I don't find that totally truthful. I was like, great. That means you might have an empty bed. Who's going to man that bed? Where's the nurse coming from? You know, do we have a nurse? You know, thank God we have enough doctors. I think some of my staff, unfortunately, is starting to get sick, but these nurses have to get imported from out of the state. And, you know, they come at a premium that a poorer state can't afford. And they don't know our system, right? They don't know our hospital. They might be the greatest nurses in the world, but they might not know your hospital. They might not know your computer system, your labs, what doctors to call.
So there's a learning curve is what you're saying for anyone that has to come in from outside of the system.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, for lack of a better word, they're useless for the first week or so. And, you know, you don't want to resort to that. First, you're paying them double. You're giving them housing, et cetera. Some of my nurses came to New York early on when we weren't hit. And they made what they would make typically in Arizona in 1 week. They made 4 weeks' salary. So it's pretty impressive.
At the very peak of the pandemic, there were state reports, local government updates, and also the federal government gave a daily briefing to the country. Federal government spent about the past 2 months not giving a briefing, finally gave a briefing with Vice President Pence about a couple days ago. Are you satisfied with the federal government's response to this crisis? And what are specific interventions that you believe need to be put in place to prevent the spread? There's about a minute left.
You know, we all admire Dr. Fauci. We think that he speaks with honesty. We read his textbooks growing up. You know, we admire him and we wish he was out there a little bit more. You know, we wish we had a better backup plan. And I tell my kids, I said, hopefully the next time this pandemic hits or something like this hits, you know, the federal government will have a better plan. There's no way my hospitals are going to step up and buy extra ventilators and have a plan B and C in place. So it'd be nicer if the federal government was more involved.
And just a final question here. How is morale doing for the doctors that you talk to?
In a word, horrendous. We all talk every time we get a little sniffle or cold. We're texting each other and saying, oh, my God, do I have COVID? Is it just from wearing my mask all day? And that's the pathetic part of it. You know, I got to wear PPEs all day. I wear two masks and then some other shields. And people can't go to a grocery store and wear a simple cloth mask, which is a minimum amount of protection, relatively comfortable because it's, quote, their freedom. I think our morale sucks. You know, once every week or so, we see one of our nurses or doctors get sick or respiratory techs. You know, I think we're all getting a little burnt and we have no release now.
Dr. LaVecchio is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Arizona in Phoenix. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As coronavirus cases rise in states across the nation, state, local, and federal responses to the pandemic have varied. And we asked you, in states where cases are on the rise, how do you feel about what's happening in your community and whether local leaders were taking steps that made you feel safe?
This is Laura from Somerville, South Carolina, and I am incredibly disturbed at how our state is handling the rise in cases. I have seen local fairs and businesses with plenty of people that space-wise shouldn't be in there. Local governments are starting to make everyone wear masks. That's about it. So no, I don't feel safe.
Hi, this is Russ from Fort Worth, Texas. And our local leaders were doing fine with the COVID-19, controlling opening and things like that until the governor got involved. And now he's having to backpedal on all the stuff he did before.
Hi, this is Kira from Jacksonville, Florida. We had approximately 9,000 new cases in Florida yesterday. Our leaders are doing nothing, absolutely nothing. Our governor will not mandate masks, nor will our local leaders here in Jacksonville. There's no shelter-in-place orders, no stay-at-home orders will go back into effect, and our governor has said he won't shut things down. So we have basically been left on our own.
Hi, this is Ariadne calling from Los Angeles, California. I am scared. I'm so worried. We have the mayor of Los Angeles reopening everything in the city, bars, nail salons, hair salons, everything. And at the same time, saying everyone should stay home because cases are on the rise. It's ridiculous.
So many of you told us that you're feeling scared, conflicted, or angry. We understand that. We also heard from a number of you talking explicitly about masks, wishing more people would wear masks in your area and that your local government should make this precaution mandatory.
My name is Sharon. I'm calling from Wichita, Kansas. In our area, we are pretty much fully open. However, I am very disappointed in our city, county, and state government for not requiring masks for everyone. People wearing masks are few and far between, and it is extremely disappointing.
Hello. I think the problem of the rising case right now is because people are not taking care of wearing masks and being careful. I think if everybody was really careful, this would not be happening. It's not so much that the leader are not doing a good job. I think they are. I think it's people are not being responsible because the hotspots are all places where they didn't quarantine properly, they didn't wear masks, and they just don't think it's true, and they don't take care of being protective for everybody. My name is Edie Bocad, and I'm calling from Venice Beach.
Carol from Oklahoma. I just took my daughter to the dentist. The office is being very safe by only allowing one person at a time in the foyer, doing temperature checks. Chairs were blocked out. Staff and patients were all required to wear PPE. However, as we're sitting there, the office staff starts talking about how they were closed the week before and went ziplining. That makes me nervous. As a special education teacher, I feel like I have to make responsible choices in my personal life so as not to bring the virus to the vulnerable people in my professional life.
Thanks for your calls, and remember that we hear you, even if your call doesn't make it on air. Let us know how you feel about what's happening in your community, especially if you're in a state where COVID-19 cases are on the rise. Are local leaders taking steps that make you feel safe? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. With states across the country continuing to battle COVID-19, a new concern is emerging: the rise of vaccine-preventable diseases in children. Because of the pandemic, some parents have hesitated to take their children to the doctor, which means fewer kids may be getting routine vaccines for things like measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, or meningitis. A recent study from the CDC showed that after the coronavirus was declared a national emergency, there in fact was a decrease in the ordering and the administering of non-influenza childhood vaccines. So the CDC is urging local, state, and federal officials to coordinate efforts to catch up fast to help prevent outbreaks of these diseases in communities across the U.S., which are already reeling from COVID-19 infections. Dr. Sarah Siddiqui is with me to talk about all this. She's a doctor of pediatric and adolescent medicine at NYU Langone Huntington Medical Group. Dr. Siddiqui, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the takeaway and making sure that we get the message across.
So let's talk about, what is the message? What are you seeing, and what do you think has to be conveyed to parents right now?
So the CDC reporting that the decrease in ordering and administration of vaccinations in March and April of this year as compared to the same time last year, and a decrease of 60%, is a significant decrease and a very big concern for pediatricians and all primary care doctors that take care of children. When we hear something like this, we definitely get very worried that we may be seeing an emergence of a vaccine-preventable disease in the time of COVID, which would be horrible. What we're trying to do is make sure that parents understand that even though they may be undergoing lockdown or they shouldn't be leaving their houses for a certain period of time, it's important to maintain contact with your pediatrician and your primary care doctor. It's important to talk to them about vaccinations that may be coming up, and it's important to make sure that they stay on schedule. We do have safety measures in place throughout the country to make sure that visits to the office or even outside the office are taking place to ensure vaccinations are given in a timely manner.
I mean, 60% decrease is a huge decrease in vaccine administrations and ordering of vaccines. So are you seeing parents yourself who are afraid to go to the doctor?
Absolutely. So in New York, where I practice, and when we were undergoing the lockdown, the severe lockdown, we were still in the office seeing patients, but nobody was coming in. And we knew that this was a huge issue. The American Academy of Pediatrics, even at that time, had suggested for pediatricians to remain open so that we may continue giving vaccines and important well care checks for newborns, infants, and children to make sure that they're maintaining their vaccine status and also their developmental checks that we do in the office. That's also so important.
Doctor, I am a new mother myself. I have a baby, and the two times that I have left the five-block radius that I've confined myself to in these 5 months was to take my son in for vaccines. And I will be honest, we did it, and it was terrifying because of the pandemic. How do you get across to your own patients that despite the fear, this is something that they really have to make sure they do?
So first of all, congratulations to you. And
thank you.
Yes, we do have many safety measures in place. But first of all, I want to say that it's so important to come into the office or to talk to your pediatrician so that we may advise you of what safety measures we have in place. So we're trying to do our part in making sure everybody's safe, but we really want to make sure that at least there's communication with your pediatrician. So you can make a phone call, you can do a video visit. We can discuss your fears with you so that we can make it as easy as possible for you to come in and get those important vaccines and visits.
One of the other things to consider, Doctor, and I hope you can help us understand this a little bit better, is that vaccines come or have to be taken in sort of a series, right? They have to be taken at a certain time in order for them to be effective. I guess the question I have is, what if a child began a series of shots before the pandemic? Parents were concerned about going out during the pandemic. Maybe they may have stopped that course of vaccines. Do they have to start again? Like, where do parents go if they, you know, may have started something and missed something during the pandemic?
So this is a very common question that you're asking. The schedule that's in place for the vaccinations is a set schedule, and that's the best studied schedule. So we do advise to always try to remain on that schedule. If, however, and there are many circumstances, in the current one is a circumstance that this happens in, there is a slight delay in the vaccine schedule or the vaccine series, you can pick up where you left off, and there is not a need to restart the series. We do have a way that we schedule the visit so that the catch-up is a little bit quicker, but we always maintain the standards of the time between each vaccine placement. So we have a set schedule, and we also have a catch-up schedule that we call it. That's a standard schedule as well that we discuss with you. And we can make sure that you're still properly protected, but we need to communicate with you. We need to make sure that you're communicating with us so we can get you in on in a timely manner and have you caught up.
We've been talking also a lot about what's going to happen in the fall. Doctor, if children are able to start congregating again and we have this vaccine lapse, what are your concerns? I mean, will unvaccinated children be able to start school at all, or is this a case-by-case basis?
So this is why it's really important to continue the conversation with your pediatrician. We do advise that you start calling now because we don't know what's going to happen in the fall. We do know that there are some areas that are opening up and camps are starting to be in session depending on your local and state Department of Health recommendations. So we can work with you and make sure that you've at least started a series or have begun the vaccination process so that it doesn't cause a delay and in your school entrance. Of course, it's very important that we mention that we should be up to date on our vaccinations when school starts, but if that's not the case and you're in the middle of a series, you will still be able to start school. We just want to make sure that the series have begun.
Also, curious about whether or not parents who are deciding to keep their kids at home, for example, still need to make sure they have those their children up to date on vaccines.
Yes, absolutely. So the one vaccine that I really mention quite a bit and make sure that people understand is the measles vaccine. So here in New York in 2018 and 2019, we did have one of the highest measles cases in the country. That scared all of us. Measles is very contagious. It's one of those diseases that is even farther than the 6 feet of exposure. It really is a difficult disease to contain once it's out in the open. And if we have decreased vaccination rates, even if children aren't returning to school, but just being in the community, you can be exposed and spread and have a pocket of increased incidence in this disease. So it's so important that we continue to vaccinate and continue to decrease the chances of that happening.
Doctor, before we let you go, I have to ask about this global rush to create a COVID-19 vaccine. Do you know where that stands?
So I do know that there are many venues in place that are currently working on a vaccine. A vaccine, when developed or during development, goes through many, many different phases of trials and research. So I have been hearing some concerns from parents regarding a vaccine that's approved for children. So right now, I believe they're working on vaccines for adults, and that it is important to understand that a vaccine does go through a thorough vetting and research and development process before it's approved in adults as well as children. So it's going to take time.
Well, we hope. Yeah. I know a lot of people are hoping that time is shortened as much as it can be. Dr.
Yes.
Sarah Siddiqui is a pediatric and adolescent medicine doctor at NYU Langone Huntington Medical Group. Dr. Siddiqui, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
When Democratic Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico was elected to Congress in 2018, she became one of the first two Native American congresswomen ever, and she emphasized climate, universal health care, and immigration rights. Today, she's speaking about the federal government's handling of tribal communities in the U.S. in the face of COVID-19, and what she and others have called an unacceptable federal response to the coronavirus in Indian country. Representative Deb Haaland is the representative for New Mexico's first congressional district, which includes Albuquerque, and is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. Representative Haaland, thanks so much for being with us again on the show.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Congresswoman, we've talked on our show before about the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 mm-hmm. has had on tribal nations across the United States. Can you give us a sense of what the effect has been like on New Mexico's indigenous communities?
Yes, of course. Well, let me first say that every single day that tribes have to wait for funding, it puts more lives at risk. And you might have seen that some tribal communities they're in the top three, right? The top three highest rates per capita of the coronavirus. And the reason for that is that Indian tribes start way behind the start line. There's some communities who don't have running water, some who don't have electricity, some whose water is polluted. There is a shortage of broadband internet service in many tribal communities. That means that there's no opportunity for telehealth or or even to contact somebody to ask questions. You know, we're experiencing these symptoms. What do we do? It's a very difficult situation. And when you think about, you know, not enough cell phone towers, not enough broadband internet, how are you going to communicate with people to let them know what they need to do for this pandemic and how they keep their communities and families safe?
Congresswoman, what's your assessment so far of how the federal government has handled the delivery, or I should say, not just the delivery of funds, but just the coronavirus pandemic when it comes to tribal communities?
So, of course, it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. We passed $8 billion for tribal governments. And just so you know, we were fighting for $20 billion for tribes in the CARES Act. The White House didn't want to give tribes a dime to begin with. We fought that. We were able to get $8 billion. As it stood, there, you know, the way they went about dispersing those funds was a disaster. And in the end, they didn't disperse all the funds. We had, as members of Congress, had to hound the Treasury to do what they are supposed to do and disperse these funds to tribal communities who need it. And so it's been terrible. And that is partly to blame for the high numbers in these communities, not to mention the fact that it was like pulling teeth to get the CDC and FEMA to respond to tribes when they were asking for PPE and other, you know, medical equipment that would save lives in their communities. So it's been, it feels like every day we're fighting, you know, fighting this administration to do their job. And it just shouldn't be like that.
Congresswoman, I'm wondering whether or not there's been, I mean, we know that the coronavirus has had many, many effects that go beyond health, and the economy has been one place that it's particularly hard hit. What has it looked like for New Mexico's tribal governments and communities so far in terms of the economic effects of COVID-19?
Sure. You know, some tribal communities, they were already facing, you know, double-digit unemployment. Some tribes have up to 45 to 50% unemployment to begin with, which is why a lot of people take matters into their own hands. We have a lot of entrepreneurs in Indian country because they can't rely on, you know, jobs. They have to create their own jobs. So if you think about somebody who makes jewelry or does art for a living, and they rely on gatherings such as powwows or feast days or whatever these gatherings are to sell their arts and crafts, and those haven't been present, it's been very difficult. And so that's why so many nonprofit organizations have stepped up. To deliver food, to deliver water, to help people to just get them past this terrible crisis. So the economies are very fragile. And so we really need to, every dime will count, you know. Yes, we're stepping it up and working as hard as we can to make sure they get what they need.
While the pandemic is really affecting the entire country, if not the entire world, there's something else that is happening in this country right now, and that's the U.S. Census. Tribal communities, Congresswoman, have been historically undercounted in the census, and I think there are concerns that because of the pandemic and the uprisings for racial justice that we're experiencing right now, that maybe the census is not at the top of everyone's mind. Are you concerned that the gap in terms of how tribal communities are undercounted will grow this year as a result?
Absolutely. Where every chance we get, we're messaging on the census. That is absolutely you. And thank you for raising it here. We need the census to make sure that we can appropriate funds to the areas who need it most. And it's ironic that the folks who really need to answer the census more than any other community, they don't have the resources to, right? I just mentioned to you that broadband internet service is an issue in many tribal communities. I was able to answer the census in 10 minutes. I could hop on my computer, answer it, close my computer. Folks,
in some of those areas don't have internet service. They don't have computers. So we rely on in-person enumerators in a lot of those rural communities. And of course, we haven't been able to send those folks out because we're in the middle of a pandemic. So the last I looked, tribal communities in my state of New Mexico were very far behind where we should be in answering the census. So we're raising it all the time. We are working with partners in the struggle to ensure that folks are answering, and we'll just do whatever we can to make sure that it happens.
I mentioned the uprising across the country for racial justice that has been going on for weeks after the killing of George Floyd. And Congresswoman, part of this racial justice uprising that we're seeing now that started even a couple of years ago after the events in Charlottesville really put a point on this idea of removing statues, and mm-hmm. particularly those that have Confederate symbolism. But it appears that there are also statues that are being removed that are of Spanish colonizers. We know that activists in New Mexico had been protesting some of these statues. Congresswoman, has the Black Lives Matter movement been intersecting with indigenous liberation movements in New Mexico? Are you noticing that?
Absolutely. Yes. So many thousands of protesters in New Mexico alone have stepped up to be a part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think that's wonderful. And of course, it raises other issues in New Mexico. The Spanish came to the Southwest in the late 1500s. And yes, they were colonizers. They killed people and used Pueblo Indians as slaves to build churches and so forth. We have, of course, through the centuries, our communities, the Native American community, the Hispanic communities, we've learned to live together. We have a painful history of colonization, but Native Americans and Hispanics have the highest rates of coronavirus, right? We have to stand together to make sure that we can get what we need to make sure our children have success in the future. And I think in the end, we absolutely are on the same side and the same struggle. And so, yes, it's a history that all New Mexicans, that belongs to all of us. And I really hope that we can stand together. If you go to New Mexico, we have a very unique cuisine, which is worth mentioning because the Spanish brought us wheat, the Spanish brought us livestock, the Indians had corn, beans, and squash. We have a beautiful New Mexican food that no one else in the country has. It's our history together that makes us strong. And so we're going to just keep working at uniting to make sure that we can advocate for the things that all of us need. We all need health care. We all need a quality education. We all need broadband internet service, as I mentioned. So I think that it's a conversation that, yes, it's worth having. People need to heal and move forward.
Congresswoman, you were one of the three co-chairs for Senator Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign. When you look at the state of the Democratic Party today, ahead of what is expected to be one of the most significant presidential elections in at least many of our lifetimes, what do you see? Where is the party headed?
Well, I think the party is, I'm very honored to be on the platform drafting committee. So it's a great group of people. I look forward to the conversations that we'll have in drafting a platform for our party. I think, you know, with the recent events with racial justice, climate change, these are all going to be big issues. But I look for the Democratic Party to work at tackling these big issues. Everybody needs to be able to go to a doctor when they're sick. We need to fight climate change. We need to make sure that police aren't targeting people of color. These are all issues I know that we'll take up. There's a diverse group of folks on this platform committee, and I think we'll have a progressive platform
that all of us can absolutely live by.
We recently had a conversation on the show about how language around identity is shifting right now. And one of the things we talked about was this term called BIPOC or BIPOC. It's an acronym that means Black people, Indigenous people, and people of color. And it's meant to affirm Black and Indigenous people and identity. Representative, how do you feel about terms like that? I mean, do you think it's important to separate Black and Indigenous people when referring to people of color?
Well, I think that, I mean, when we think about the beginning of our country, right, this was all Indian land before it was ever the United States, before it was ever a colonized continent by the Europeans when they came over here in the late 1400s. We are, wherever you're sitting in the United States, you're sitting on Indian land. The United States happened because of genocide of Indian tribes all over the country, starting on the East Coast, coming up from the Southwest and everywhere in between. And so I think that we all, that is our history. We have to recognize that we have different histories, different historical traumas. Indigenous peoples are unique because we are sovereign Indian nations within the United States. The federal government has a trust responsibility to Indian tribes. So I absolutely feel like we are in, yes, we should be recognized as such. So I think it's important to always acknowledge that, yes, this was Indian land. Our Indigenous folks, you know, we've had incredible struggles. And in fact, I mentioned the genocide of Indians. That was a precursor to how people would treat the African American slaves who eventually became our African American populations with violence and unspeakable horror. So I think in that sense, yes, we're different than a lot of other communities who came over after a lot of this happened.
And Congresswoman, one, we are in a moment that's very difficult for so many people around the world, and so many people here in the United States are having a tough time, whether it's because of the coronavirus pandemic, the racial unrest that we're seeing and uprising, or just generally, you know, people who have lost their jobs. So we're in a tough historical moment right now. And here on the show, mm-hmm. we've been asking people what they're doing to find moments of joy. And it can be the smallest thing imaginable. It could be a cup of coffee that you have every day. But is there something, Congresswoman, that you do to find joy in your everyday?
Absolutely. And we have to, right? I'm so grateful that my daughter is with me. She is, you know, she was in Brooklyn and I implored her to come home until the virus passed. And so she's been with me. And I also have four dogs. So between taking the dogs for walks with my daughter and having an opportunity to connect with her every day. And of course, cooking. I have cooked more in the past 3 months than I ever have, just because we've been staying home. And so I find absolute joy in, you know, taking the bounty of our earth and turning it into good food that fuels our body for the big fights that we have to fuel ourselves for.
Representative Deb Holland is the Democratic representative for New Mexico's 1st Congressional District, which includes Albuquerque. She was elected in 2018 and is a member of the Laguna Pueblo tribe. Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. You take care.
It was almost a year ago when I sat down in the studio with comedian Rami Youssef, and we talked about his self-titled Hulu show, stand-up comedy, and the way his home state of New Jersey gets so much hate. And now Rami's out with the second season of his show, but sitting down to talk face-to-face in the same room wasn't an option. So instead, we got him on the line from Los Angeles, and we talked about how his team finished editing the show during lockdown and what he's been feeling about the current moment.
You look for the escape in a way. And I'm very fortunate that the work that I'm escaping to, I think, can provide at least some sort of conversation that I think, you know, we're in a reflective place right now. And a lot of the work, especially with the show, I think is about characters who are seeking and asking questions. And so in many ways, it feels like a natural fit, because I think that's a lot of what a lot of us are doing right now.
Rami also told me how he's been responding to the nationwide racial justice uprising beyond attending Black Lives Matter protests in Los Angeles.
Just trying to listen to not only the Black leaders, but the Black creatives in my own life. One of my very good friends, Patrice Cullors, who co-founded Black Lives Matter, has always been someone that I really look up to creatively and also just on an organizing level. And so really making sure that we're listening to the people who have been around for a really long time making these things happen. You know, this isn't a new thing. And so really trying to plug into that. And so just been listening to her, collaborating with her. We did Seth Meyers together. I was supposed to go on to Seth Meyers and do like a little late night thing, pandemic thing, to promote my show. And then I actually just was like, hey, can Patrice talk? And so we just did it together. And I was just like, hey, can you just talk? Because I have nothing to say right now.
I know Patrice. I met Patrice very early on in the Black Lives Matter movement. So I can imagine that went quite well on the show. And speaking of media, specifically social media, you recently shared a message on social media from Arabs for Black Lives, which is a collective that you were really trying to call attention to anti-Blackness in and among non-Black Arabs. Tell us about what that is like. It's something, it feels almost like it might be similar to what the Latino community faces among itself with anti-Blackness.
Yeah. I think that there is this perception that there's a narrative that I think we kind of try to push of white people versus people of color, and we try and make it a very binary argument. But I think when you look at the umbrella of people of color, whatever that might mean to various people, there's a lot of anti-Blackness. And I think that looking at that in our own communities is really important. Because it's something that I think, again, can get swept away or disregarded, but it's very present. And so for me, as someone who I have the only Arabic speaking show in America at the moment, it felt very important. We address it in the show, and we also we look at it outside of the show on just on a community level.
Speaking of the show, the second season of your show features several Black Muslim characters. How do you approach telling their stories?
I think, you know, we had on from the writer's room level, but then also just from looking at who we cast. I mean, Mahershala Ali joined us to play my character's Sheikh, and he plays a Black Sufi Sheikh, and he's a Black Muslim convert. And so it's impossible to craft a character like that without getting on the phone with him, going for a walk with him, and really digging into it. And it's something that I really enjoy doing with all the characters on my show. The woman who plays my sister, we're getting into her storyline, and I call her, and I try and make it personal to her while also maintaining the narrative arc that I have in my head and where I want it to go. And so a lot of our show is really collaborative in that way, where we're really wanting to find authentic performances, and that feels like it has to be a collaboration, not just in the writer's room, but also on set. And so we're constantly, whether it be in the pre-planning phases of it, or sometimes you shoot a scene and then you're like, oh, actually this would feel better, and everyone kind of feels that way. So it's just constantly evolving and moving, and a lot of that comes from that dialogue.
When Black Lives Matter first emerged years ago, it wasn't something that a lot of people embraced. In fact, it was something that some people outrightly rejected and stayed away from. That has now changed, and we see everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people, young and old, multiracial, multi-ethnic folks out there protesting. And we've also seen corporate America suddenly stand behind and put out statements of support behind Black Lives Matter and racial justice. What are you seeing in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think you're feeling it. I think it's something that I'm hearing from network executives, where they're saying we're really want to make sure that we are producing projects from Black creators, where we are making sure that there is diversity in our writers' rooms. I mean, these are the types of conversations that have always kind of been happening. But I think what people don't realize is Hollywood is corporate America. And I think that Hollywood prides itself on being ahead of things, on being on the right side of an issue. I think there is a kind of moral presentation that comes out of Hollywood, but it's honestly no different from any, you know, like you walk into a creative place and you're like, is this Staples headquarters? Like there's no real difference. They have to be pushed to the brink. I remember talking about making a show that followed a Muslim American family, and I was constantly told from the most creative people that it would maybe make sense if it was a character or if it was a family that moved in next to a white family. It was always kind of put to me as it needed to be in reference to whiteness. And then, you know, we have the current president run, and he starts saying we need to ban Muslims. And then people all of a sudden are like, oh wait, maybe we do have a problem and maybe we need to zone in on it. So it's really, it's a corporation. And so they're definitely taking note. It's obviously very late in the game, but they're doing it probably at about the same rate as, you know, whatever company your dad works at.
My dad's retired. But
where did he work?
My dad actually was a public school teacher in New York City for many, many, many years. So he retired. Jeez.
That's talk about someone who was probably underpaid and needs way more appreciation.
Underpaid, overworked, and did it,
God.
And went into some of the toughest communities and lived in some of the toughest communities in New York City, and then worked in some of the toughest communities in New York City. And yes, yeah, so I come from a family of educators. They were smart enough not to go into media.
Well, but that's actual change making. You know, I get so frustrated when people are like, man, TV is changing things. And I'm like, no, people like your dad are changing things. TV might set a little bit of an emotional palette to open a few minds, but that's not the work. It's just, that's just like an appetizer for the real work that happens. And that's really, and I think honestly, even just on an education level, you look at how many parents have basically become teachers during the pandemic. And I'm pretty sure every parent is like, man, we really need to pay these people way more. Because everyone
videos that were crumbling. Coming out during that time from parents who were just like, my God, please take our children and we'll pay you, you know, triple. But going, I mean, back to you, Rami, I think one of the things that we've been trying to dissect on the show, or that we were trying to dissect on the show pre-pandemic, was sort of the limits of comedy, right? When there was a lot of blowback about, you know, what's considered politically correct or not politically correct. And now things have changed. I mean, the pandemic and the social uprising that we're seeing has obviously affected all of us. But what effect has it had on comedy? Is comedy really an escape right now, or should it respond to directly to whatever's going on in the world? I mean, how do you make that distinction for yourself and your work?
Well, it's interesting because I think the instantaneous value of comedy right now is it's a bit stuck because we, for stand-ups, we can't really do the thing that we love doing, which is getting in front of a group of people. There have been, like, Michael Che has gotten some outdoor shows going in New York, parking lot situations. And I was talking to him and I was like, oh, I might try and like launch one in LA. And I had one set up. And then I was looking at the COVID numbers spiking and I really am thinking to myself, I'm like, can I really justifiably bring together people, even though it's outdoors right now while this is happening? And it was actually a show I was going to host with Patrice, and we were kind of going to get some money together to donate. So it's not like it wasn't, there wasn't a cause and there wasn't a way to get people to laugh and think. But then you just look at what's happening on a pandemic level, and it becomes really hard to make something like that or actually consciously be like, yeah, let me get people together to hear me talk through a microphone. So it's really been this time for me where I'm just, it's more self-reflective. It's more, I'm writing a ton, but I'm not necessarily releasing. And I think internet comedy has its vein of processing things that are going on. But it's really hard to pull off a nuanced joke on the internet. And it's really hard to get intention across on the internet. And I am someone who believes you can tell a joke about anything if you really earn it. I think there is a, you could tell a George Floyd joke, but you really better earn it. And it really better be rooted in something that makes people feel less lonely and that really connects to what's happening without devaluing what happened. And I believe in that type of joke. And I believe that that can happen. But I think it's really hard to do that when you're not in front of people and you're not able to really workshop it in a room with people. Anything that you just do on the internet, for the most part, there's a few exceptions, but a lot of times it's just really hard to get that that real connection and that real thoughtfulness.
Rami, I've got to let you go, but I just want to ask really quickly, are you doing anything right now that brings you joy amid all the craziness?
I've been just trying to connect with people that a lot of the times, you know, life gets in the way. And so I'm talking to friends I haven't talked to as long as I have probably for years. Cooking, reading, you know, just everyone became a cook. Everyone started baking bread. You know, so I've baked some bread and just been, you know, just trying to reevaluate as much as I can and, you know, praying that everyone I know is able to stay healthy and you know, for everybody. So it's just one of those times where we're, you know, I think we're all looking inward.
Yes, we are. Rami Youssef is a comedian, writer, and actor. Rami, thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
And that's all for us today. I'm so glad you chose to spend some time with us and talk to us as well. You can give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And we know this is a time in history that can be really scary and unsettling, so we really appreciate you trusting us and listening in every day. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.